essentially no impact on them, they'd all just come along for the ride. It's useful to include those particles, though, because our second story can now be augmented to comprise not only a copy of you examining a device that's undertaken a measurement, but also copies of the surrounding laboratory, the rest of Earth in orbit around the sun, and so on. This means that each spike in story two language corresponds to what we traditionally call a bona fide universe. In one such universe, you see Strawberry Fields on the display's reading. In the other, Grant's tomb. If the electron's original probability wave had, say, 4 spikes, or 5, or 100, or any number, the same would follow. The wave evolution would result in 4, or 5, or 100, or any number of universes. In the most general case, a spread-out wave is composed of spikes at every location, and so the wave evolution would yield a vast collection of universes, one for each possible position. As advertised, though, the only thing that happens in any of these scenarios is that a probability wave enters Schrödinger's equation, his math goes to work, and out comes a wave with a modified shape. There is no cloning machine. There is no splitting machine. That's why I said earlier that such words can give a misleading impression. There's nothing but a probability wave evolution machine, driven by the lean mathematical law of quantum mechanics. When the resulting waves have a particular shape, we retell the mathematical story in type 2 language and conclude that in each spike, there's a sentient being situated within a normal-looking universe, certain that he sees one and only one definite result for the given experiment. If I could somehow interview all these sentient beings, I'd find each to be an exact replica of the others. Their only point of departure would be that each would attest to a different definite result. And so, whereas Bohr and the Copenhagen gang would argue that only one of these universes would exist, because the act of measurement, which they claim lies outside of Schrödinger's purview, would collapse away all the others, and whereas a first-pass attempt to go beyond Bohr and extend Schrödinger's math to all particles, including those constituting equipment and brains, yielded dizzying confusion because a given machine or mind seemed to internalize all possible outcomes simultaneously, Everett found that a more careful reading of Schrödinger's math leads somewhere else, to a plentiful reality populated by an ever-growing collection of universes. Prior to the publication of Everett's 1957 paper, a preliminary version was circulated to a number of physicists around the world. Under Wheeler's guidance, the paper's language had been abbreviated so aggressively that many who read it were unsure as to whether Everett was arguing that all the universes in the mathematics were real. Everett became aware of this confusion and decided to clarify it. In a note added in proof that he seems to have slipped in just before publication, and apparently without Wheeler's notice, Everett sharply articulated his stance on the reality of the different outcomes. From the viewpoint of the theory, he said, all are actual, none any more real than the rest. When is an alternative a universe? Besides the loaded words splitting and cloning, we've freely invoked two other grand terms in our Type 2 stories, world and, interchangeably in this context, universe. Are there guidelines for determining when this usage is appropriate? When we consider a probability wave for a single electron that has two or more spikes, we don't speak of two or more worlds. Instead, we speak of one world, ours, containing an electron whose position is ambiguous. Yet, in Everett's approach, when we measure or observe that electron, we speak in terms of multiple worlds. What is it that distinguishes the unmeasured and the measured particle, yielding descriptions that sound so radically different? One quick answer is that for a single isolated electron, we don't tell a type 2 story because without a measurement or an observation, there's no link to human experience that's in need of articulation. The type 1 story of a probability wave evolving via Schrödinger's math is all that's needed. And without a Type 2 story, there's no opportunity to invoke multiple realities. Although this explanation is adequate, it proves worthwhile to delve a little deeper, revealing a special feature of quantum waves that comes into play when many particles are involved. To grasp the essential idea, it's easiest to think back on the double slit experiment. Recall that an electron's probability wave encounters the barrier, and two wave fragments make it through the slits and travel onward to the detector screen. Inspired by our many world discussion, you might be tempted to think of the two racing waves as representing separate realities. In one, an electron whisks through the left slit. In the other, an electron whisks through the right slit. But you promptly realize that the intermingling of these supposedly distinct realities profoundly affects the experiment's outcome. The intermingling is why an interference pattern is produced. So it doesn't make much sense, nor does it yield any particular insight, to consider the two wave trajectories as existing in separate universes. If we change the experiment, however, by placing a meter behind each slit that records whether or not an electron passes through it, the situation is radically different. Because macroscopic equipment is now involved, the two distinct trajectories of an electron generate differences in a huge number of particles. The huge number of particles in the meter's displays that register electron pass through left slit or electron pass through right slit. And because of this, the respective probability wave for each possibility becomes so disparate that it's virtually impossible for them to have any subsequent influence on each other. The differences between the billions and billions of particles in the meters cause the waves for the two outcomes to shift away from each other, leaving negligible overlap. And with no overlap, the waves don't engage in any of the hallmark interference phenomena of quantum physics. Indeed, with the meters in place, the electrons no longer yield the bright, dark, bright pattern. The interference pattern doesn't form. Physicists say that the probability waves have decohered. The point, then, is that once decoherence sets in, the waves for each outcome evolve independently. There's no intermingling between the distinct possible outcomes, and each can thus be called a world or a universe of its own. For the case at hand, in one such universe, the electron goes through the left slit and the meter displays left. In another universe, the electron goes through the right slit and the meter records right. In this sense, and only in this sense, there's resonance with Bohr. According to the many worlds approach, big things made of many particles do differ from small things made from one particle or a mere handful. Big things don't stand outside the basic mathematical law of quantum mechanics, as Bohr thought, but they do allow probability waves to acquire enough variations that their capacity to interfere with one another becomes negligible. And once two or more waves can't affect one another, they become mutually invisible. Each thinks the others have disappeared. So, whereas Bohr argued away by fiat all but one outcome in a measurement, the many worlds approach, combined with decoherence, ensures that within each universe, it appears as though the other outcomes have vanished. Within each universe, that is, it's as if the probability wave has collapsed. But compared with the Copenhagen approach, the as if provides for a very different picture of the expanse of reality. In the many worlds view, all outcomes, not just one, are realized. Uncertainty at the cutting edge. This might seem like a good place to end the chapter. We've seen how the bare bones mathematical structure of quantum mechanics leads us by the nose to a new conception of parallel universes. Yet the chapter still has a fair way to go. In the remainder, I'll explain why the many worlds approach to quantum physics continues to be controversial. We will see that the resistance goes well beyond the queasiness some feel about the conceptual leap into such an unfamiliar perspective on reality. But in case you've reached saturation and feel compelled to skip ahead to the next chapter, here's a short summary. In day-to-day life, probability enters our thinking when we face a range of possible outcomes, but for one reason or another, we're unable to figure out which will actually happen. Sometimes we have enough information to determine which outcomes are more or less likely to occur, and probability is the tool that makes such insights quantitative. Our confidence in a probabilistic approach grows when we find that the outcomes deemed likely happen often, and those deemed unlikely happen rarely. The challenge facing the many-worlds approach is that it needs to make sense of probability, quantum mechanics' probabilistic predictions, in a wholly different context, one that envisions all possible outcomes happening. The dilemma is simple to state. How can we speak of some outcomes being likely and others being unlikely when all take place? In what follows, I'll explain the issue more fully and discuss attempts to address it. Be warned, we are now deep into cutting-edge research, so opinions vary widely on where we currently stand. A probable problem. A frequent criticism of the many-worlds approach is that it's just too baroque to be true. The history of physics teaches us that successful theories are simple and elegant. They explain data with a minimum of assumptions and provide an understanding that's precise and economical. A theory that introduces an ever-growing cornucopia of universes falls way short of this ideal. Proponents of the many-worlds approach argue, credibly, that in assessing the complexity of a scientific proposal, you shouldn't focus on its implications. What matters is the fundamental features of the proposal itself. The many-worlds approach assumes that a single equation, Schrödinger's, governs all probability waves all the time. So for simplicity of formulation and economy of assumptions, it's hard to beat. The Copenhagen approach is surely no simpler. It, too, invokes Schrödinger's equation, but it also includes a vague, ill-defined prescription for when Schrödinger's equation should be turned off, and then an even less detailed prescription regarding the process of wave collapse that is meant to take its place. That the many-worlds approach leads to an exceptionally rich picture of reality is no more a black mark against it than the rich diversity of life on Earth is a black mark against Darwinian natural selection. Mechanisms that are fundamentally simple can give rise to complicated consequences. Nevertheless, while this establishes that Occam's razor isn't sharp enough to pare away the many-worlds approach, the proposal surfeit of universes does yield a potential problem. Earlier, I said that in applying a theory, physicists need to tell two kinds of stories, the story describing how the world evolves mathematically and the story that links the math to our experiences. But there's actually a third story related to these two that the physicist must also tell. It's the story of how we've come to have confidence in a given theory. For quantum mechanics, the third story generally goes like this. Our confidence in quantum mechanics comes from its phenomenal success in explaining data. If a quantum expert uses the theory to calculate that in repeating a given experiment, we expect one outcome to happen, say, 9.62 times more often than another, that's what experimenters invariably see. Turning this around, had results not agreed with quantum predictions, experimenters would have concluded that quantum mechanics wasn't right. Well, actually, being careful scientists, they would have been more cautious. They would have called it doubtful that quantum mechanics was right, but would have noted that their results didn't rule out the theory definitively. Even a fair coin tossed 1,000 times can have surprising runs that defy the odds. But the larger the deviation, the more one suspects the coin is not fair. The larger the experimental deviations from those predicted by quantum mechanics, the more strongly the experimenters would have suspected that quantum theory was mistaken. That confidence in quantum mechanics could have been undermined by data is essential. With any proposed scientific theory that has been suitably developed and understood, we should be able to say, at least in principle, that if upon doing such and such an experiment, we don't find such and such results, our belief in the theory should diminish. And the more that observations deviate from predictions, the greater the loss of credibility should be. The problem with the many worlds approach, and the reason it remains controversial, is that it may compromise this means for assessing the credibility of quantum mechanics. Here's why. When I flip a coin, I know there's a 50% chance that it will land heads and a 50% chance that it will land tails. But that conclusion rests on the usual assumption that a coin toss yields a unique result. If a coin toss yields heads in one world and tails in another, and moreover, if there's a copy of me in each world who witnesses the outcome, what sense can we make of the usual odds? There'll be someone who looks just like me, has all my memories, and emphatically claims to be me, who sees heads, and another being equally convinced that he's me, who sees tails. Since both outcomes happen, there's a Brian Green who sees heads and a Brian Green who sees tails, the familiar probability of there being an equal chance that Brian Green will see either heads or tails seems nowhere to be found. The same concern applies to an electron whose probability wave is hovering near Strawberry Fields and Grant's tomb. Traditional quantum reasoning says that you, the experimenter, have a 50% chance of finding the electron at either location. But in the many worlds approach, both outcomes happen. There's a you who will find the electron at Strawberry Fields, and another you who will find the electron at Grant's tomb. So, how can we make sense of the traditional probabilistic predictions, which in this case say that with equal odds, you'll see one result or the other? The natural inclination of many people when they first encounter this issue is to think that among the various yous in the many worlds approach, there's one who's somehow more real than the others. Even though each you in each world looks identical and has the same memories, the common thought is that only one of these beings is really you. And this line of thought continues, it's that you who sees one and only one outcome to whom the probabilistic predictions apply. I appreciate this response. Years ago, when I first learned about these ideas, I had it too. But the reasoning runs completely counter to the many worlds approach. Many worlds practices minimalist architecture. Probability waves simply evolve by Schrodinger's equation. That's it. To imagine that one of the copies of you is the real you is to slip in through the back door something closely akin to Copenhagen. Wave collapse in the Copenhagen approach is a brutish means for making one and only one of the possible outcomes real. If in the many worlds approach you imagine that one and only one of the yous is really you, you're doing the same thing, just a little more quietly. Such a move would erase the very reason for introducing the many worlds scheme. Many worlds emerged from Everett's attempt to address the failings of Copenhagen, and his strategy was to invoke nothing beyond the battle-tested Schrodinger equation. This realization shines an uncomfortable light on the many worlds approach. We have confidence in quantum mechanics because experiments confirm its probabilistic predictions. Yet, in the many worlds approach, it's hard to see how probability even plays a role. How, then, can we tell the third kind of story, the one that should provide the basis of our confidence in the many worlds scheme? That's the quandary. On reflection, it's not surprising that we bumped into this wall. There's nothing at all chancy in the many worlds approach. Waves simply evolve from one shape to another in a manner described fully and deterministically by Schrodinger's equation. No dice are thrown, no roulette wheels are spun. By contrast, in the Copenhagen approach, probability enters through the hazily defined measurement-induced wave collapse. Again, the larger the wave's value at a given location, the larger the probability that the collapse will put the particle there. That's the point in the Copenhagen approach where dice throwing makes an appearance. But since the many worlds approach abandons collapse, it abandons the traditional entry point for probability. So, is there a place for probability in the many worlds approach? Probability and many worlds. Everett surely thought there was. The bulk of his 1956 draft dissertation, as well as the truncated 1957 version, was devoted to explaining how to incorporate probability in the many worlds approach. But a half century later, the debate still rages. Among those physicists and philosophers who spend their professional lives puzzling over the issue, there is a wide range of opinions on how and whether many worlds and probability come together. Some have argued that the problem is insoluble, and so the many worlds approach should be discarded. Others have argued that probability, or at least something that masquerades as probability, can indeed be incorporated. Everett's original proposal provides a good example of the difficult points that arise. In everyday settings, we invoke probability because we generally have incomplete knowledge. If, when a coin is tossed, we know enough details, the coin's precise dimensions and weight, precisely how the coin was thrown, and so on, we'd be able to predict the outcome. But since we generally don't have that information, we resort to probability. Similar reasoning applies to the weather, the lottery, and every other familiar example where probability plays a role. We deem the outcomes chancy only because our knowledge of each situation is limited. Everett argued that probabilities find their way into the many worlds approach because an analogous ignorance from a thoroughly different source necessarily creeps in. Inhabitants of the many worlds only have access to their single world. They do not experience the others. Everett argued that with such a limited perspective comes an infusion of probability. To get a feel for how, leave quantum mechanics for a moment and consider an imperfect but helpful analogy. Imagine that aliens from the planet Zaxtar have succeeded in building a cloning machine that can make identical copies of you, me, or anyone. Were you to step into the cloning machine and were two of you then to step out, both would be absolutely convinced that they were the real you, and both would be right. The Zaxtarians delight in subjecting less intelligent life forms to existential dilemmas, so they swoop down to Earth and make you the following offer. Tonight, when you go to sleep, you'll be carefully wheeled into the cloning machine. 5 minutes later, two of you will be wheeled out. When one of you awakes, life will be normal, except that you will have been granted any wish of your choosing. When the other you awakes, life won't be normal. You'll be escorted to a torture chamber back on Zaxtar, never to leave. And no, your lucky clone is not allowed to wish for your release. Do you accept the offer? For most people, the answer is no. Since each of the clones really, truly is you, in accepting the offer, you'd be guaranteeing that there will be a you who awakens to a life of torment. Sure, there will also be a you who awakens to your usual life augmented by the unlimited power of an arbitrary wish. But for the you on Zaxtar, there'll be nothing but torture. The cost seems too high. Anticipating your reluctance, the Zaxtarians up the ante. Same deal, but now they'll make 1,000,001 copies of you. 1,000,000 will wake up on 1,000,000 identical-looking Earths with the power to fulfill any wish. One will get the Zaxtarian torture. Do you accept now? At this point, you begin to waver. Heck, you think. The odds seem pretty good that I won't end up on Zaxtar, but instead will wake up right here at home, wish in hand. This last intuition is particularly relevant to the many worlds approach. If odds entered your thinking because you imagine that only one of the 1,000,001 clones is the real you, then you've not taken in the scenario fully. Each copy is you. There's a 100% certainty that one of you will wake up to an unbearable future. If this was indeed what led you to think in terms of odds, you need to let it go. However, probability may have entered your thinking in a more refined way. Imagine that you just agreed to the Zaxtarian offer and are now contemplating what it will be like to wake up tomorrow morning. Curled up under your warm duvet, just regaining consciousness but not yet having opened your eyes, you'll remember the Zaxtarian deal. At first, it will seem like an unusually vivid nightmare, but as your heart starts to pound, you'll recognize that it is real, that 1,000,001 copies of you are in the process of waking up, with one of you destined for Zaxtar and the others about to be granted extraordinary power. What are the odds, you'll ask yourself nervously, that when I open my eyes, I'll be shipping out to Zaxtar? Before the cloning, there was no sensible way to speak of whether it was or wasn't likely that you'd be Zaxxar bound. It is absolutely certain that there will be such a you, so how could it be unlikely? But after the cloning, the situation seems different. Each clone experiences itself as the real you. Indeed, each is the real you. But each copy is also a separate and distinct individual who can inquire about his or her own future. Each of the million and one copies can ask for the probability that they will go to Zaxxar. And since each knows that only one of the million and one will wake up to that outcome, each reckons that the odds of being that unlucky individual are low. Upon waking, a million will find their cheery expectation confirmed, and only one will not. So, although there's nothing uncertain, nothing chancy, nothing probabilistic in the Zaxxarian scenario, again, no dice are rolled, no roulette wheel spun, probability nevertheless seems to enter. It does so through the subjective ignorance experienced by each individual clone regarding which outcome he or she will witness. This suggests a tack for injecting probabilities into the many worlds approach. Before you undertake a given experiment, you are much like your pre-cloned self. You contemplate all outcomes allowed by quantum mechanics and know that there's a 100% certainty that a copy of you will see each. Nothing at all chancy has made an appearance. You then undertake the experiment. At that point, as with the Zaxxarian scenario, a notion of probability presents itself. Each copy of you is an independent, sentient being capable of wondering about which world he or she happens to inhabit. The likelihood, that is, that when the experiment's results are revealed, he or she will see this or that particular outcome. Probability enters through each inhabitant's subjective experience. Everett's approach, which he described as objectively deterministic, with probability reappearing at the subjective level, resonated with this strategy, and he was thrilled by the direction. As he noted in the 1956 draft of his dissertation, the framework offered to bridge the position of Einstein, who famously believed that a fundamental theory of physics should not involve probability, and the position of Bohr, who was perfectly happy with a fundamental theory that did. According to Everett, the many worlds approach accommodated both positions, the difference between them merely being one of perspective. Einstein's perspective is the mathematical one, in which the grand probability wave of all particles relentlessly evolves by the Schrödinger equation, with chance playing absolutely no role. I like to picture Einstein soaring high above the many worlds of the many worlds approach, watching as Schrödinger's equation fully dictates how the entire panorama unfolds, and happily concluding that even though quantum mechanics is correct, God doesn't play dice. Bohr's perspective is that of an inhabitant in one of the worlds, also happy, using probabilities to explain with stupendous precision those observations to which his limited perspective gives him access. It's a captivating vision, Einstein and Bohr agreeing on quantum mechanics. But there are pesky details that for more than half a century have convinced many that it's still too early to sign on. Those who have studied Everett's thesis generally agree that while his intent was clear, a deterministic theory that to its inhabitants nevertheless appears probabilistic, he didn't convincingly spell out how to achieve it. For example, much in the spirit of the material covered in Chapter 7, Everett sought to determine what a typical inhabitant of the many worlds would observe in any given experiment. But unlike our focus in Chapter 7, in the many worlds approach, the inhabitants we need to contend with are all the same person. If you're the experimenter, they are all you, and collectively, they will see a range of different outcomes. So, who is the typical you? Inspired by the Zaxxarian scenario, a natural suggestion is to count the number of yous who will see a given result. The outcome seen by the greatest number of yous would then qualify as typical. Or, more quantitatively, define the probability of a result to be proportional to the number of yous who see it. For simple examples, this works. If the probability wave for an electron has two equal height spikes, located at Strawberry Fields and Grant's tomb, And if you then measure the electron's position, there'll be one of you who sees each outcome, and so you peg the odds at 50-50 for seeing one result or the other. That's good. The usual quantum mechanical prediction is also 50-50 because the probability wave heights at the two locations are equal. However, consider a more general situation in which the probability wave heights are unequal. If the wave is 100 times larger at Strawberry Fields than at Grant's Tomb, then quantum mechanics predicts that you are 100 times more likely to find the electron at Strawberry Fields. But in the many worlds approach, your measurement still generates one you who sees Strawberry Fields and another you who sees Grant's Tomb. The odds based on counting the number of yous is thus still 50-50, the wrong result. The origin of the mismatch is clear. The number of yous who see one result or another is determined by the number of spikes in the initial probability wave. But the quantum mechanical probabilities are determined by something else, not by the number of spikes, but by their relative heights. And it's these predictions, the quantum mechanical predictions, which have been convincingly confirmed by experiments. Everett developed a mathematical argument that was meant to address this mismatch. Many others have since pushed it further. In broad strokes, the idea is that in calculating the odds of seeing one or another outcome, we should place ever less weight on universes whose wave heights are ever smaller. But this is perplexing and controversial. Is the universe in which you find the electron at Strawberry Field somehow 100 times as genuine, or 100 times as likely, or 100 times as relevant as the one in which you find it at Grant's Tomb? These suggestions would surely create tension with the belief that every world is just as real as every other. After more than 50 years, during which distinguished scientists have revisited, revised, and extended Everett's arguments, many agree that the puzzles persist. Yet, it remains seductive to imagine that the mathematically simple, totally bare-bones, profoundly revolutionary many-worlds approach yields the probabilistic predictions that form the foundation of belief in quantum theory. This has inspired many other ideas beyond the Zaxterian-type reasoning for joining probability and many-worlds. A prominent proposal comes from a leading group of researchers at Oxford, including, among others, David Deutsch, Simon Saunders, David Wallace, and Hilary Greaves. They've developed a sophisticated line of attack that focuses on a seemingly boorish question. If you're a gambler and you believe in the many-worlds approach, what's the optimum strategy for placing bets on quantum mechanical experiments? Their answer, which they argue for mathematically, is that you'd bet just as Niels Bohr would. When speaking of maximizing a return, these authors have in mind something that would have sent Bohr into a tizzy. They're considering an average over the many inhabitants of the multiverse who claim to be you. But even so, their conclusion is that the numbers that Bohr and everyone since have been calculating and calling probabilities are the very numbers that should guide how you wager. That is, even though quantum theory is fully deterministic, you should treat the numbers as if they were probabilities. Some are convinced that this completes Everett's program. Some are not. The lack of consensus on the crucial question of how to treat probability in the many-worlds approach is not all that unexpected. The analyses are highly technical and also deal with a topic, probability, that is notoriously tricky even outside its application to quantum theory. When you roll a die, we all agree that you have a 1 in 6 chance of getting a 3, and so we predict that over the course of, say, 1,200 rolls, the number 3 will turn up about 200 times. But since it's possible, in fact likely, that the number of 3s will deviate from 200, what does the prediction mean? We want to say that it's highly probable that 1/6 of the outcomes will be 3s, but if we do that, then we've defined the probability of getting a 3 by invoking the concept of probability. We've gone circular. That's just a small taste of how the issues, beyond their intrinsic mathematical complexity, are conceptually slippery. Throw into the mix the added many-worlds intricacy of you no longer referring to a single person, and it's no wonder that researchers find ample points of contention. I have little doubt that full clarity will one day emerge, but not yet, and perhaps not for some time. Predictions and understanding. For all these controversies, quantum mechanics itself remains as successful as any theory in the history of ideas. The reason, as we've seen, is that for the kinds of experiments we can do in the laboratory, and for many of the observations we can make of astrophysical processes, we have a quantum algorithm that produces testable predictions. Use Schrödinger's equation to calculate the evolution of the relevant probability waves, and use the results, the various wave heights, to predict the probability that you'll find one outcome or another. As far as predictions are concerned, why this algorithm works, whether the wave collapses upon measurement, whether all possibilities are realized in their own universes, whether some other process is at work, is secondary. Some physicists argue that even calling the issue secondary accords it more status than it deserves. In their view, physics is only about making predictions, and as long as different approaches don't affect those predictions, why should we care which is ultimately correct? I offer three thoughts. First, beyond making predictions, physical theories need to be mathematically coherent. The Copenhagen approach is a valiant effort, but it fails to meet this standard. At the critical moment of observation, it retreats into mathematical silence. That's a substantial gap. The many worlds approach attempts to fill it. Second, in some situations, the predictions of the many worlds approach would differ from those of the Copenhagen approach. In the Copenhagen approach, the process of collapse ensures that after a measurement, a probability wave would have a single spike. In the many worlds approach, it generally would have more than one spike. So if you could cause the spiked waves, representing macroscopically distinct situations, to interfere, generating a bright, dark, bright pattern similar to that found in the double slit experiment, it would establish that Copenhagen's hypothesized wave collapse didn't happen. Because of decoherence, as discussed earlier, it's an extraordinarily formidable task to do this. But at least theoretically speaking, the Copenhagen and many worlds approaches yield different predictions. It's an important point of principle. The Copenhagen and many worlds approaches are often referred to as different interpretations of quantum mechanics. This is an abuse of language. If two approaches can yield different predictions, you can't call them mere interpretations. Well, you can, and people do, but the terminology is off the mark. Third, physics is not just about making predictions. If one day we were to find a black box that always and accurately predicted the outcome of our particle physics experiments and our astronomical observations, the existence of the box would not bring inquiry in these fields to a close. There's a difference between making predictions and understanding them. The beauty of physics, its raison d'etre, is that it offers insights into why things in the universe behave the way they do. The ability to predict behavior is a big part of the power of physics, but the heart of physics would be lost if it didn't give us a deep understanding of the hidden reality underlying what we observe. And should the many worlds approach be right, what a spectacular reality our unwavering commitment to understanding predictions will have uncovered. I don't expect theoretical or experimental consensus to come in my lifetime concerning which version of reality, a single universe, a multiverse, something else entirely, which quantum mechanics embodies. But I have little doubt that future generations will look back upon our work in the 20th and 21st centuries as having nobly laid the basis for whatever picture finally emerges. Chapter 9. Black Holes and Holograms. The Holographic Multiverse. Plato likened our view of the world to that of an ancient forebear watching shadows meander across a dimly lit cave wall. He imagined our perceptions to be but a faint inkling of a far richer reality that flickers beyond reach. 2 millennia later, it seems that Plato's cave may be more than a metaphor. To turn his suggestion on its head, reality, not its mere shadow, may take place on a distant boundary surface, while everything we witness in the three common spatial dimensions is a projection of that faraway unfolding. Reality, that is, may be akin to a hologram, or really, a holographic movie. Arguably the strangest parallel world entrant, the holographic principle envisions that all we experience may be fully and equivalently described as the comings and goings that take place at a thin and remote locus. It says that if we could understand the laws that govern physics on that distant surface and the way phenomena there link to experience here, we would grasp all there is to know about reality. A version of Plato's shadow world, a parallel but thoroughly unfamiliar encapsulation of everyday phenomena, would be reality. The journey to this peculiar possibility combines developments deep and far-flung, insights from general relativity, from research on black holes, from thermodynamics, quantum mechanics, and, most recently, string theory. The thread linking these diverse areas is the nature of information in a quantum universe. Information. Beyond John Wheeler's knack for finding and mentoring the world's most gifted young scientists, besides Hugh Everett, Wheeler's students included Richard Feynman, Kip Thorne, and, as we will shortly see, Jacob Bekenstein. He had an uncanny ability to identify issues whose exploration could change our fundamental paradigm of nature's workings. During a lunch we had at Princeton in 1998, I asked him what he thought the dominant theme in physics would be in the decades going forward. As he had frequently done that day, he put his head down as if his aging frame had grown weary of supporting such a massive intellect. But now the length of his silence left me wondering, briefly, whether he didn't want to answer or whether, perhaps, he had forgotten the question. He then slowly looked up and said a single word, information. I wasn't surprised. For some time, Wheeler had been advocating a view of physical law quite unlike what a fledgling physicist learns in the standard academic curriculum. Traditionally, physics focuses on things, planets, rocks, atoms, particles, fields, and investigates the forces that affect their behavior and govern their interactions. Wheeler was suggesting that things, matter and radiation, should be viewed as secondary, as carriers of a more abstract and fundamental entity, information. It's not that Wheeler was claiming that matter and radiation were somehow illusory. Rather, he argued that they should be viewed as the material manifestations of something more basic. He believed that information, where a particle is, whether it is spinning one way or another, whether its charge is positive or negative, and so on, forms an irreducible kernel at the heart of reality. That such information is instantiated in real particles occupying real positions having definite spins and charges is something like an architect's drawings being realized as a skyscraper. The fundamental information is in the blueprints. The skyscraper is but a physical realization of the information contained in the architect's design. From this perspective, the universe can be thought of as an information processor. It takes information regarding how things are now and produces information delineating how things will be at the next now and the now after that. Our senses become aware of such processing by detecting how the physical environment changes over time. But the physical environment itself is emergent. It arises from the fundamental ingredient, information, and evolves according to the fundamental rules, the laws of physics. I don't know whether such an information-theoretic stance will reach the dominance in physics that Wheeler envisioned. But recently, driven largely by the work of physicists Gerard Atuft and Leonard Susskind, A major shift in thinking has resulted from puzzling questions regarding information in one particularly exotic context: black holes. Black holes. Within a year of General Relativity's publication, the German astronomer Karl Schwarzschild found the first exact solution to Einstein's equations, a result that determined the shape of space and time in the vicinity of a massive spherical object, such as a star or a planet. Remarkably, not only has Schwarzschild found his solution while calculating artillery trajectories on the Russian front during World War I, but he also had beaten the master at his own game. To that point, Einstein had found only approximate solutions to the equations of general relativity. Impressed, Einstein publicized Schwarzschild's achievement, presenting the work before the Prussian Academy. But even so, he failed to appreciate a point that would become Schwarzschild's most tantalizing legacy. Schwarzschild's solution shows that familiar bodies like the Sun and the Earth produce a modest curvature, a gentle depression in the otherwise flat space-time trampoline. This matched well the approximate results Einstein had managed to work out earlier. But by dispensing with approximations, Schwarzschild could go further. His exact solution revealed something startling. If enough mass were crammed into a small enough ball, a gravitational abyss would form. The space-time curvature would become so extreme that anything venturing too close would be trapped. And because anything includes light, such regions would fade to black, a characteristic that inspired the early term dark stars. The extreme warping would also bring time to a grinding halt at the star's edge, hence another early label, frozen stars. Half a century later, Wheeler, who was nearly as adept at marketing as he was at physics, popularized such stars both within and beyond the scientific community with a new and more memorable name, black holes. It stuck. When Einstein read Schwarzschild's paper, he agreed with the mathematics as applied to ordinary stars or planets. But as to what we now call black holes, Einstein scoffed. In those early days, it was a challenge, even for Einstein, to fully understand the intricate mathematics of general relativity. While the modern understanding of black holes was still decades away, the intense folding of space and time already apparent in the equations was, in Einstein's view, too radical to be real. Much as he would resist cosmic expansion a few years later, Einstein refused to believe that such extreme configurations of matter were anything more than mathematical manipulations based on his own equations run amok. When you see the numbers that are involved, it's easy to come to a similar conclusion. For a star as massive as the Sun to be a black hole, it would need to be squeezed into a ball about 3 kilometers across. A body as massive as the Earth would become a black hole only if squeezed to about 1 centimeter across. The idea that there might be such extreme arrangements of matter seems nothing short of ludicrous. Yet, in the decades since, astronomers have gathered overwhelming observational evidence that black holes are both real and plentiful. There is wide agreement that a great many galaxies are powered by an enormous black hole at their center. Our very own Milky Way galaxy is believed to revolve around a black hole whose mass is about 3 million times that of the Sun. There's even a chance, as discussed in Chapter 4, that the Large Hadron Collider may produce tiny black holes in the laboratory by packing the mass and energy of violently colliding protons into such a minuscule volume that Schwarzschild's result again applies, though on microscopic scales. Extraordinary emblems of math's ability to illuminate the dark corners of the cosmos, black holes have become the cynosures of modern physics. Besides serving as a boon for observational astronomy, black holes have also been a fertile source of inspiration for theoretical research by providing a mathematical playground in which physicists can push ideas to their limits, conducting pen and paper explorations of one of nature's most extreme environments. As a weighty case in point, In the early 1970s, Wheeler realized that when the venerable second law of thermodynamics, a guiding light for over a century in understanding the interplay between energy, work, and heat, was considered in the vicinity of a black hole, it seemed to flounder. The fresh thinking of Wheeler's young graduate student, Jacob Bekenstein, came to the rescue, and in doing so, planted the seeds of the holographic proposal. The second law. The aphorism, less is more, takes many forms. Let's have the executive summary, just the facts, TMI, you had me at hello. These idioms are so common because every moment of every day we're bombarded with information. Thankfully, in most cases, our senses pare down the details to those that really matter. If I'm out on the savannah and encounter a lion, I don't care about the motion of every photon reflecting off his body. Way TMI. I just want particular overall features of those photons, the very ones our eyes have evolved to sense and our brains to rapidly decode. Is the lion coming toward me? Is he crouched and stalking? Provide me with a moment-to-moment catalog of every reflected photon and, sure, I'll be in possession of all the details. What I won't have is any understanding. Less would indeed be very much more. Similar considerations play a central role in theoretical physics. Sometimes we want to know every microscopic detail of a system we're studying. At the locations along the Large Hadron Collider's 17-mile-long tunnel, where particles are steered into head-on collisions, physicists have placed mammoth detectors capable of tracking, with extreme precision, the motion of the particle fragments produced. Essential for gaining insight into the fundamental laws of particle physics, the data are so detailed that a year's worth would fill a stack of DVDs about 50 times as tall as the Empire State Building. But as in that impromptu meeting with the lion, there are other situations in physics where that level of detail would obscure, not clarify. A 19th century branch of physics called thermodynamics, or in its more modern incarnation, statistical mechanics, focuses on such systems. The steam engine, the technological innovation that initially drove thermodynamics, as well as the Industrial Revolution, provides a good illustration. The core of a steam engine is a vat of water vapor that expands when heated, driving the engine's piston forward, and contracts when cooled, returning the piston to its initial position, ready to drive forward once again. In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, physicists worked out the molecular underpinnings of matter, which, among other things, provided a microscopic picture of the steam's action. As steam is heated, its H2O molecules pick up increasing speed and careen into the underside of the piston. The hotter they are, the faster they go, and the bigger the push. A simple insight, but one essential to thermodynamics, is that to understand the steam's force, we don't need the details of which particular molecules happen to have this or that velocity, or which happen to hit the piston precisely here or there. Provide me with a list of billions and billions of molecular trajectories, and I'll look at you just as blankly as I would if you listed the photons bouncing off the lion. To figure out the piston's push, I need only the average number of molecules that will hit it in a given time interval and the average speed they'll have when they do. These are much coarser data, but it's exactly such pared-down information that's useful. In crafting mathematical methods for systematically sacrificing detail in favor of such higher-level aggregate understanding, physicists honed a wide range of techniques and developed a number of powerful concepts. One such concept, encountered briefly in earlier chapters, is entropy. Initially introduced in the mid-19th century to quantify energy dissipation in combustion engines, the modern view, emerging from Ludwig Boltzmann's work in the 1870s, is that entropy provides a characterization of how finely arranged or not the constituents of a given system need to be for it to have the overall appearance that it does. To get a feel for this, imagine that Felix is frantic because he believes the apartment he shares with Oscar has been broken into. "They've ransacked us," he tells Oscar. Oscar brushes him off. Surely Felix is having one of his moments. To make his point, Oscar throws open the door to his bedroom, revealing clothing, empty pizza boxes, and crushed beer cans strewn everywhere. "It looks just like it always does," Oscar barks. Felix isn't swayed. "Of course it looks the same. Ransack a pigsty, and you get a pigsty. But look at my room." And he throws open his own door. "Ransacked," mocks Oscar. "It's neater than a straight whiskey." "Neat, yes, but the intruders have left their mark. My vitamin bottles, not lined up in order of size. My collected works of Shakespeare, out of alphabetical order. And my sock drawer? Look at this. Some black pears are in the blue bin. Ransacked, I tell you. Obviously ransacked." Putting Felix's hysteria aside, the scenario makes plain a simple but essential point. When something is highly disordered, like Oscar's room, a great many possible rearrangements of its constituents leave its overall appearance intact. Grab the 26 crumpled shirts that were scattered across the bed, floor, and dresser, and toss them this way and that. Fling the 42 crushed beer cans randomly here or there, and the room will look the same. But when something is highly ordered, like Felix's room, even small rearrangements are easily detected. This distinction underlies Boltzmann's mathematical definition of entropy. Take any system and count the number of ways its constituents can be rearranged without affecting its gross overall macroscopic appearance. That number is the system's entropy. If there's a large number of such rearrangements, then entropy is high. The system is highly disordered. If the number of such rearrangements is small, entropy is low. The system is highly ordered, or equivalently, has low disorder. For more conventional examples, consider a vat of steam and a cube of ice. Focus only on their overall macroscopic properties, those you can measure or observe without accessing the detailed state of either's molecular constituents. When you wave your hand through the steam, you rearrange the positions of billions upon billions of H2O molecules, and yet the vat's uniform haze looks undisturbed. But randomly change the positions and speeds of that many molecules in a piece of ice, and you'll immediately see the impact. The ice's crystalline structure will be disrupted. Fissures and fractures will appear. The steam, with H2O molecules randomly flitting through the container, is highly disordered. The ice, with H2O molecules arranged in a regular crystalline pattern, is highly ordered. The entropy of the steam is high. Many rearrangements will leave it looking the same. The entropy of the ice is low. Few rearrangements will leave it looking the same. By assessing the sensitivity of a system's macroscopic appearance to changes to its microscopic details, entropy is a natural concept in a mathematical formalism that focuses on aggregate physical properties. The second law of thermodynamics developed this line of insight quantitatively. The law states that over time, the total entropy of a system will increase. Understanding why requires only the most elementary grasp of chance and statistics. By definition, a higher entropy configuration can be realized through many more microscopic arrangements than a lower entropy configuration. As a system evolves, it's overwhelmingly likely to pass through higher entropy states since, simply put, there are more of them. Many more. When bread is baking, you smell it throughout the house because there are trillions more arrangements of the molecules streaming from the bread that are spread out, yielding a uniform aroma, than there are arrangements in which the molecules are tightly packed in a corner of the kitchen. The random motions of the hot molecules will, with near certainty, drive them toward one of the numerous spread-out arrangements and not toward one of the few clustered configurations. The collection of molecules evolves, that is, from lower to higher entropy, and that's the second law in action. The idea is general. Glass shattering, a candle burning, ink spilling, perfume pervading. These are different processes, but the statistical considerations are the same. In each, order degrades to disorder and does so because there are so many ways to be disordered. The beauty of this kind of analysis, insight that provided one of the most potent aha moments in my physics education, is that without getting lost in the microscopic details, we have a guiding principle to explain why a great many phenomena unfold the way they do. Notice, too, that being statistical, the second law does not say that entropy can't decrease, only that it's extremely unlikely to do so. The milk molecules you just poured into your coffee might, as a result of their random motions, coalesce into a floating figurine of Santa Claus. But don't hold your breath. A floating milk Santa has very low entropy. If you move around a few billion of his molecules, you'll notice the result. Santa will lose his head or an arm, or he'll disperse into abstract white tendrils. By comparison, a configuration in which the milk molecules are uniformly spread around has enormously more entropy. A vast number of rearrangements continue to look like ordinary coffee with milk. With a huge likelihood, then, the milk poured into your dark coffee will turn it a uniform tan with nary a Santa in sight. Similar considerations hold for the vast majority of high to low entropy evolutions, making the second law appear inviolable. The second law and black holes. Now to Wheeler's point about black holes. Back in the early 1970s, Wheeler noticed that when black holes amble onto the scene, the second law appears compromised. A nearby black hole seems to provide a ready-made and reliable means for reducing overall entropy. Throw whatever system you're studying, smashed glass, burned candles, spilled ink, into the hole. Since nothing escapes from a black hole, the system's disorder would appear permanently gone. Crude the approach may be, but it seems easy to lower total entropy if you have a black hole to work with. The second law, many thought, had met its match. Wheeler's student Bekenstein was not convinced. Perhaps, Bekenstein suggested, entropy is not lost to the black hole, but merely transferred to it. After all, no one claimed that, in gorging themselves on dust and stars, black holes provide a mechanism for violating the first law of thermodynamics, the conservation of energy. Instead, Einstein's equations show that when a black hole gorges, it gets bigger and heftier. The energy in a region can be redistributed, with some falling into the hole and some remaining outside, but the total is preserved. Maybe, Bekenstein suggested, the same idea applies to entropy. Some entropy stays outside a given black hole, and some entropy falls in, but none gets lost. This sounds reasonable, but experts shot Bekenstein down. Schwarzschild's solution, and much work that followed, seemed to establish that black holes are the epitome of order. Infalling matter and radiation, however messy and disordered, are crushed to infinitesimal size at a black hole center. A black hole is the ultimate in orderly trash compaction. True, no one knows exactly what happens during such powerful compression, because the extremes of curvature and density disrupt Einstein's equations. But there just doesn't seem to be any capacity for a black hole center to harbor disorder. And outside the center, a black hole is nothing but an empty region of space-time, extending to the boundary of no return, the event horizon. With no atoms or molecules wafting this way and that, and thus no constituents to rearrange, a black hole would seem to be entropy-free. In the 1970s, this view was reinforced by the so-called no-hair theorems, which established mathematically that black holes, much like the ball performers of Blue Man Group, have a dearth of distinguishing characteristics. According to the theorems, any two black holes that have the same mass, charge, and angular momentum, rate of rotation, are identical. Lacking any other intrinsic traits, as the blue men lack bangs, mullets, or dreads, black holes seem to lack the underlying differences that would harbor entropy. By itself, this was a fairly convincing argument, but there was a yet more damning consideration that seemed to definitively undercut Bekenstein's idea. According to basic thermodynamics, there's a close association between entropy and temperature. Temperature is a measure of the average motion of an object's constituents. Hot objects have fast-moving constituents. Cold objects have slow-moving constituents. Entropy is a measure of the possible rearrangements of these constituents that, from a macroscopic viewpoint, would go unnoticed. Both entropy and temperature thus depend on aggregate features of an object's constituents. They go hand in hand. When worked out mathematically, it became clear that if Bekenstein was right, and black holes carried entropy, they should also have a temperature. That idea set off alarm bells. Any object with a non-zero temperature radiates. Hot coal radiates visible light. We humans typically radiate in the infrared. If a black hole has a non-zero temperature, the very laws of thermodynamics that Bekenstein was seeking to preserve state that it, too, should radiate. But that conflicts blatantly with the established understanding that nothing can escape a black hole's gravitational grip. Most everyone concluded that Bekenstein was wrong. Black holes do not have a temperature. Black holes do not harbor entropy. Black holes are entropy sinkholes. In their presence, the second law of thermodynamics fails. Despite the evidence mounting against him, Bekenstein had one tantalizing result on his side. In 1971, Stephen Hawking realized that black holes obey a curious law. If you have a collection of black holes with various masses and sizes, some engaged in stately orbital waltzes, others pulling in nearby matter and radiation, and still others crashing into each other, the total surface area of the black holes increases over time. By surface area, Hawking meant the area of each black hole's event horizon. Now, there are many results in physics that ensure quantities don't change over time. Conservation of energy, conservation of charge, conservation of momentum, and so on. But there are very few that require quantities to increase. It was natural, then, to consider a possible relation between Hawking's result and the second law. If we envision that, somehow, the surface area of a black hole is a measure of the entropy the black hole contains, then the increase in total surface area could be read as an increase in total entropy. It was an enticing analogy, but no one bought it. The similarity between Hawking's area theorem and the second law was, in almost everyone's view, nothing more than a coincidence. Until, that is, a few years later when Hawking completed one of the most influential calculations in modern theoretical physics. Hawking radiation. Because quantum mechanics plays no role in Einstein's general relativity, Schwarzschild's black hole solution is based purely in classical physics. But proper treatment of matter and radiation, of particles like photons, neutrinos, and electrons that can carry mass, energy, and entropy from one location to another, requires quantum physics. To fully assess the nature of black holes and understand how they interact with matter and radiation, we must update Schwarzschild's work to include quantum considerations. This isn't easy. Notwithstanding advances in string theory, as well as other approaches we haven't discussed, such as loop quantum gravity, twisters, and topos theory, we are still at an early stage in our attempt to meld quantum physics and general relativity. Back in the 1970s, there was still less theoretical basis for understanding how quantum mechanics would affect gravity. Even so, a number of early researchers developed a partial union of quantum mechanics and general relativity by considering quantum fields, the quantum part, evolving in a fixed but curved space-time environment, the general relativity part. As I mentioned in Chapter 4, a full union would, at the very least, consider not only the quantum jitters of fields within space-time, but the jitters of space-time itself.